everybody. I'm Seth for Privacy, privacy advocate, educator, and head of strategy and marketing at Foundation, and you're listening to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons. I'm your host, Kerry Parker, as always, and today we have episode 374 for April 29th, 2024, and it is almost the end of April, which means that the Dragon Challenge coin promotion is almost over. Like, you've got till tomorrow, April 30th. Go to fdsd.me/promo424 for all the details. Now, the treasure chest part of that, where I have promo codes for things like Proton and Safing and Malwarebytes, that's got to keep going. But if you want to get that super cool Dragon Challenge coin, I'm not sure when the next time I'll do one of these promotions is again. But now is your last chance for a little while anyway, so get on that if you want to get the coin. So today we're going to talk with Seth from Seth for Privacy about CBDC. And no, that's not like some marijuana derivative. It is a central bank digital currency. So what is central bank digital currency? Well, we're going to get into that today, but it's effectively digital dollars or digital euros. It's created and managed by the government, though it is not backed by gold or silver. So it's like fiat money in that sense. And yeah, it's going to get a little technical, not just in terms of cryptocurrency, but also financial. We're going to talk about some kind of macroeconomic things. But don't worry, you know, too much about the technology. I will give you a little bit of a rundown here. But what I really want you to focus on today are the important aspects of what we're going to discuss today are really privacy, you know, sovereignty and independence. And think about this in terms of actual, like, regular money, what we're used to. When was the last time you actually paid for something using cash or coins? We use credit cards really either directly or indirectly with our smartphone payment apps for just about everything today. It's even got to the point where, you know, when you're going out to lunch with some people and you want to split the bill, you don't get money out anymore. You might ask the server or whatever to split it on your credit cards, but, you know, some people also will whip out the Cash App or Venmo or something and split it up that way. And the important thing to understand is that none of those digital transactions are private. Every single one of those transactions, including the date, the time, the vendor, often the place, as in location, the amount, and often even information about exactly what it was you purchased, is being recorded somewhere and almost surely sold off to third parties as well for marketing purposes. But if you want to buy something online today, privately or anonymously, you really can't do it with these payment methods, and you certainly can't use cash. So cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin and Monero, when done properly, and that's a big caveat, can be and should be like digital cash, basically untraceable and anonymous, though in practice that gets kind of tricky, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today. But we're going to kind of back up and look at the forest view a lot today as well. It's not just about the personal aspects of this, but also really the societal aspects, the macroeconomic effects of what it means to not have a private, sovereign way to pay for things in the digital world. So we have today already many, 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 almost too many different flavors of cryptocurrency. And these were created by people, not governments. And you know, it was kind of a fad early on. But now the governments have seen that it has gotten to be a big deal. They're making sure they get their cut when it comes to taking, you know, tax revenue from profits. But now they want to take it a step further. Now governments are actually saying, why don't we have our own government-backed cryptocurrency? That is CBDC. So before we get into this interview with Seth, I'll go over a couple terms here really quick. First of all, when you're using the term crypto, the real diehards, the OGs, will say that crypto is short for cryptography, not cryptocurrency. So when you're throwing around that word, if you really want to be pedantic and, you know, pay respect to the people who have been working on cryptography for decades, don't use crypto to mean cryptocurrency. Just say cryptocurrency. Otherwise, when you're talking about crypto, it should be either cryptography or Superman's dog if you spell it with a K. We're going to throw around some terms today like blockchain and what it means to be off-chain, which means it's not part of the blockchain ledger. Blockchain is just a digital global ledger of transactions. We discussed this at length with Seth the first time he was on the show when we talked about cryptocurrency. We called that Cryptocurrency 101. And if you want to learn all that stuff, I highly recommend you go back and check out that episode. But today, just don't worry too much about those terms, because the real issue here is what it means for the government to be getting involved with cryptocurrency and what the implications are for society and for our privacy. We do talk about ETFs or exchange-traded funds. That's just basically something that's traded on stock exchanges and things like that. I will say that we talk about Chinese currency and how that is pronounced. I always thought it was yuan. Some people call it yuan. I've heard that it's more technically the yuan. But anyway, we kind of cover those bases in the show. I just will apologize for me not pronouncing it however it's supposed to be pronounced. But that is what we're talking about. All right, that's enough of a preview, I think. Let's get into our interview with Seth on central bank digital currency. Seth is a privacy advocate and educator focused on helping people learn to use freedom tech like Bitcoin and Monero. He's also the head of strategy marketing at Foundation, editor of freedom.tech, and host of the Opt Out podcast. Welcome back to the show, Seth.
Thank you so much for having me, Carrie. I really enjoyed the last time we talked. I don't know, it was
almost 2 years ago. Yeah,
it's almost 2 years ago. Wow.
Yeah, okay. Time flies. Yeah.
Several lifetimes at this point.
Yeah, in tech for sure. Yeah, it's great to have you back. I agree, it's been too long. We should have done this sooner. But I ran across something, an article that got me thinking, and the first person I thought it was you. So it's about state-backed or state-sponsored cryptocurrency, and we'll get into that in a minute. But let's catch up a little bit, because it seems like AI has been all over the news, and it's kind of supplanted cryptocurrency in the mainstream news cycle. So I feel a little out of touch. Tell us what's been going on in the world of digital currency since we last talked. Have there been any big stories or major changes? Catch us up a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's hard to kind of summarize 2 years in the space since then. I mean, I think the part that makes it a little bit easier is that it's been a bear market, which in the cryptocurrency space means lots of stuff gets built, but nothing super exciting happens. There's no like crazy things or crazy market or anything like that. But it's my favorite time in this space because we get to kind of dive into the technical details, learn more about how these crazy things work, get to see new cool things built on top of things like Bitcoin, Monero. And so it's a fun time. I think the biggest things that have happened that I've seen, and just for full disclosure, the only things I really watch in the cryptocurrency space are Bitcoin and Monero, and then a little bit of Ethereum. So I'm sure there's other stuff in here that I'm not going to capture that some of your listeners would know about. But the biggest things for me, I think, have been that the Bitcoin space is finally coming to grips with the fact that Lightning, which is an attempt at a layer two network for Bitcoin to make it easier to make fast payments, cheaper to make payments, is not the perfect solution for everything. And just as almost always happens, these kind of situations where you're building a protocol and trying to figure out how to build on top of it. The same thing has happened with Lightning Network, where it has some very good specific benefits, but it's not the end all be all. And we need better, what are usually called layer two networks, essentially a way to be able to send and receive Bitcoin without having to make an actual on-chain payment that gets recorded into the Bitcoin ledger every time, because that gets expensive.
Yeah,
there's a limited space. You have to pay for every time you do that, so that we need some alternative way with some small trade-offs but without sacrificing the security of Bitcoin. And Lightning Network has proven to not be the perfect solution for everyone. Great for business to business, great in some specific use cases for individual users, some specific models that are really starting to work well now. But because of that realization, the Bitcoin space has kind of seen an explosion in the last really like 6 months of people exploring what else can be built as when it comes to Bitcoin layer twos, including this novel idea that essentially allows you to execute arbitrary things off chain called BitVM, that allows you to do a lot more on Bitcoin than we originally thought that you could. There are some big trade-offs with that. in that the actual execution and the amount of data that has to be transferred to do this is expensive, but it's off chain. You're not paying for Bitcoin block space to do it. You're able to do it just over the internet connected to other people that are doing this. That's a very, very TLDR explanation, but it essentially just kind of restarted interest in building on Bitcoin because we don't have to change as much at the base layer as we thought we did to do more exciting things like better layer two networks. So I think that's probably the biggest thing in Bitcoin. Before I mention Monero, anything kind of jump out to you from there, Carrie?
All right. Well, and I don't want to get off on a tangent right away, but I bet a lot of people don't understand like gas fees and what it takes to do some of these transactions. So again, without getting hyper technical or going way off on a tangent, because we'll just stay there. What help people understand who don't trade in Bitcoin all the time? What some of the practical implications are of trying to do transactions with Bitcoin?
Yeah, so it's pretty straightforward once you grasp the concept, but essentially just what it is in order to pay for space in the Bitcoin blockchain, which is there's a block every 10 minutes, every block is up to 4 megabytes, you have to compete with everyone else who wants that block space. So sometimes there's not enough people competing and you could just pay the minimum fee and get into a block. But as has been the case for a lot of the last really year at this point, there has been a lot of competition, which means that when you want to be included in Bitcoin's blockchain quickly, like let's say you want to pay someone and you need it to be actually confirmed on chain, which means you have the security guarantees that Bitcoin offers, and you want it to be confirmed on chain within 10 minutes, you need to pay, you need to outcompete everyone else almost. You have to be able to fit into that next block. So you have to pay a lot of fees if there's a market for that block space. And it's essentially a free market where you're just competing for inclusion into the next block. So you can pay a lot and make sure that you get included immediately. You can pay less and hope that you'll be included within the next maybe hour, 24 hours, whatever kind of your time span is. Or sometimes you can pay the minimum and then just kind of hope that at some point it gets included. Although we've had such a rush for fees that actually if you've been trying to pay the minimum, your transaction hasn't even been propagated to the network because it's too low of a fee. It's below this kind of lower bound that happens when you have a very full set of transactions waiting to be included. So it's essentially just you have to pay for block space, and the amount you have to pay depends on how quickly you want to be in the Bitcoin blockchain or how long you're willing to wait. You can increase or decrease the amount that you pay, but it's an open market, so it can change quite quickly.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So back on topic a little bit. How have countries, like nation states, been dealing with this decentralized cryptocurrency? We're going to talk about the state-backed stuff here in a little bit. But I mean, the stuff that's there now, Bitcoin and Monero and some of the other ones, they've been struggling to figure out how to deal with this. Obviously, there's been enough transactions in it that they want to get their tax revenue. So that's usually a driver. You know, they'll perk their ears up, right? It was kind of like for the longest time when we didn't have to pay taxes at Amazon, and then it got to be such a big deal, the government was like, we want a slice of that. But besides that, besides that aspect, I know some companies, you know, wholeheartedly supported. I think it was El Salvador that actually moved to Bitcoin as legal tender, which I don't think worked out terribly well for them. Some others tolerate it, and some of them actually ban it. So what has the stance been for different countries on dealing with this decentralized cryptocurrency?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to see that unfold. It does differ a lot based on what countries we're talking about. Like there have been just complete outright bans. You're not allowed to buy, sell, mine, etc. Mostly in the Middle East, I think there have been bans around that.
And has that been because they don't like the privacy aspects of it? They don't like the fact that and we're going to talk about that later too. But is that the reasoning behind this? Because they can't trace it?
So the hard thing is when we're talking Bitcoin, it can be traced, and nation states have been, especially big nation states like the U.S. government, have been tracing it. So that I don't think that's as much of the concern as it is that it's a potential way to escape capital controls or escape inflation to avoid having to use the national currency, which obviously potentially harms the nation whose currency that is. And it can potentially be used for tax evasion. Obviously, it's not necessarily even great at that because Bitcoin itself isn't private by default. There are ways to make it more private. But the thing that we've seen most often is not an outright ban, but rather governments cracking down on any way to acquire Bitcoin that doesn't require you to give over your actual like government ID pictures of yourself. What we in the kind of the Bitcoin space and also in the banking space call KYC or know your customer, which is a banking law from a long time ago. But essentially KYC and then AML, which is anti-money laundering, is a set of banking laws that when you're working with the traditional bank require you to give over your ID and stuff to open a bank account, that sort of thing.
Right.
Which we're used to there. But when you're actually dealing with cryptocurrency, it's a lot stranger because you're not dealing with the US dollar where at, in some way, I mean, as horrible as it is, I think that KYC AML are very detrimental and have not shown to be positive almost at all across the board, even in the legacy financial system. But when you're dealing with cryptocurrency, like you're talking Bitcoin, this isn't the US government's money. There's no real reason why they should have sovereignty over anyone who's choosing to buy or sell a currency that they do not control other than tax purposes. And obviously, like you hinted at, that's where they try to really lock down. Is that I think it's simple for them to understand that if they lock down the on and off ramps, the ways you actually buy and sell Bitcoin, a lot of the privacy goes away. Because if you have an actual government ID attached to all of the purchases made by this person, you see them withdraw to the Bitcoin chain. But if they just continue to use Bitcoin normally, it's trivial for the government to see exactly what they do with it, where it goes next, if they sold it, etc. So they understand that locking down those on and off ramps is the easiest way for them to gain some measure of control over Bitcoin. It doesn't necessarily mean that they can confiscate it. Confiscation is still a lot harder in Bitcoin. It doesn't necessarily mean that they can trace it because you can gain privacy using some tools on Bitcoin as well. So there are some protections for the person who does go that route, but that's been far and away the biggest way that governments have tried to both get a tax cut and I think leverage what little control they can have over Bitcoin, because that's the sticking point. And we've seen the furthest example of that with Monero, where even though Monero as a currency, as far as I know, is not banned anywhere except maybe Japan. There was like a weird ban a few years ago, and I'm pretty sure it was Japan. But what they have done is instead of just like in Bitcoin, restricting it to you can buy and sell it on these regulated exchanges, give over your ID, you can buy it. They've actually started to crack down and prevent exchanges from listing it or force exchanges to delist it. Wow. So they're trying to make it impossible to even acquire Monero legally, which is, again, that's the easiest way for them to control. It doesn't prevent you from acquiring Monero necessarily. It doesn't prevent you from using it. And there's, as far as I know, in almost any country, there's no law against using Monero, but they're trying to make it harder to acquire because they understand that most people, if they run up against that barrier of entry, are just going to give up, go back to using their local fiat currency and give up that control back to the government.
Yeah, and because most of us don't deal in large sums of money, I don't think most of us probably aren't aware, but there's in the legacy cash systems, there's a lot of those kind of controls too. You know, like you said, if you do a transaction of more than, I think, $10,000, that triggers some automatic systems to flag it. And sometimes that will get you noticed, trying to prevent money laundering and shifting large amounts of money around. We have that existing in the legacy systems too, in one way, shape or form. But we don't often run into that. And you're right. It's almost in the other sense with the cryptocurrency, as long as you stay within the realm of digital currency, you have certain capabilities, anonymity and flexibility. But the trouble is most people want to turn that into fiat currency so they can actually buy things at Amazon with it or whatever, or buy pizza. Though they used to be able to buy pizza with Bitcoins too. Those are funny stories. Those poor people spent a Bitcoin on a pizza, you know,
10,000 Bitcoin, I believe was the famous story. Yeah.
Right. But so, all right. So let's talk about this notion of cryptocurrencies being touted as digital cash. Cause we were kind of flirting with that. It's kind of touted as a way, first of all, being decentralized. As you said, it's not nation state backed. It's not a fiat currency that we're used to, where it's controlled by a Federal Reserve, for example, and the value is controlled by nation state. So there's that macroeconomic aspect to it. But a lot of people, I think, mostly think of anonymity. But the devil is always in the detail. So let's dive a little bit deeper when you're talking about the differences even between Bitcoin and Monero. What are the practical aspects of getting in and out of that, and where are the touch points where you can lose this much vaunted anonymity?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question, and it's one that will take a long time to break down. So I'll try to kind of give the high level overview of what the landscape looks like. I'll just, for the purposes of simplicity, talk about Bitcoin and Monero. There are lots of other cryptocurrencies with varying levels of anonymity or really privacy. But when
you,
it comes
real
to...
Real quick, would you put Bitcoin and Monero at the opposite ends of that spectrum?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I would say the best way that I've found to describe Bitcoin is that it has extremely fragile pseudonymity. Mm-hmm. So in Bitcoin, you have the pseudonyms of the addresses that you actually use to receive funds. And then when you spend, you're spending from those addresses to other people. So while those are legitimately pseudonyms, if, like we talked about before, you've attached your government ID to this transaction because you purchased your Bitcoin on like a Coinbase, you give over your ID, you withdrew the Bitcoin, the government knows that your ID goes with this pseudonym of the Bitcoin address you withdrew to. And it's, if you use Bitcoin the standard way, you're not going to break that link at any point. So the government will continue to be able to at least make a very strong assumption that your whatever pseudonym changes, you send to different addresses, whatever, that you're still the same person. So that's where that fragile pseudonymity very quickly breaks down. Monero, I would say, is on the other side of the spectrum, which is... I hate to use the term anonymous because it's not anonymous is obviously a very extreme term,
right?
But it's essentially anonymous as a currency. Even if you use one of these regulated exchanges, you give over your ID, you buy Monero, you withdraw Monero, under most circumstances, the exchange and or government would be able to know, obviously, that you bought Monero and that you withdrew it, but they wouldn't be able to see what you did after it, after that initial withdrawal. And that's the clearest separation for most people, because for better or worse, most people are coming in through an exchange that requires them to give over their ID. So they're going to be breaking that fragile pseudonymity that Bitcoin has right away. And while there are tools to gain privacy, and we can touch on those maybe a little bit today, but the best one by far is Samurai Wallet, which is a mobile wallet, or Sparrow Wallet, which is a desktop wallet, and both use the same privacy tool called Whirlpool. To break those deterministic links. Those can't erase the record of you buying Bitcoin, but they can do a similar thing to Monero. It's harder, it costs more, it's not quite as good, but they can do a similar thing and make it so that once you withdraw and you go through these privacy tools, you can break that link so that it's not easy to be surveilled.
Now, is that what they call a mixer, or is that different?
So I'm hesitant to use the word mixer just because the government loves to use the term mixer for privacy tools that actually take custody of your Bitcoin to provide you privacy. So in all of the government's court cases, and a very, very big court case was just settled this last week about a custodial Bitcoin mixer where you would actually send them your Bitcoin. You give up custody of it entirely. You don't have the Bitcoin at all. You send them your Bitcoin. They do some black magic behind the scenes. You don't know what happens. And they send you some different Bitcoin after a time delay, an hour or 6 hours, whatever.
So that's a really heavy-duty trust situation. And it really, I mean, let's face it, it sounds like money laundering, right?
Unfortunately, by by the legal definitions in the U.S., it is unfortunately money transmission. And if the money is illegally used, money laundering.
Right. That is a pejorative term, right? Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, whether or not that's justified, it is true. Because unfortunately, there are lots of people who use these tools who are just legitimate,
sure,
good users.
Yep.
They want privacy. Even in this case, this case was around a mixer called Bitcoin Fog. Around this case, the person who supposedly ran Bitcoin Fog, which that's a whole story for another day, as far as anyone else can tell, was just a user of Bitcoin Fog and had sent money to them, had just wanted to get privacy. They were selling Bitcoin to people just directly peer-to-peer for cash. They wanted some privacy, so they used this tool for privacy. And that's true of the vast majority of these types of tools, where they get this connotation of money laundering or evil usage, when in reality, the majority of people using them really just want to gain privacy through them. But yes, definitely under the U.S.'s jurisdiction, if you're taking custody, like as the mixer, you're definitely money transmission business. There's a lot of legal stuff that goes into that. So that's almost always not going to fly with at least the U.S. government and anybody who listens to them. But you can use a tool like the Samurai Wallet and Sparrow Wallet, which you can call mixers. The actual like tool that they use under the hood is something called CoinJoin in Bitcoin, which essentially just means that you are trustlessly creating a single transaction between multiple people. So in the case of Whirlpool, which is the tool that Sparrow Wallet and Samurai Wallet use, you can think of it like you and four other people put $20 into a hat, or $20 bills into a hat, someone shuffles them up. Technically, you shuffle them up, but you do it in a cryptographic way so that you can't know which bill is whose at the end. And then you each just grab a $20 bill on the way out. Hmm. There's no way for you to know if that one was yours, if it was someone else's, whose it is. So it breaks that deterministic link between if I had just given you the $20 bill, you'd know it was mine. But if I use that service, it could be someone else's. It makes it so that there's not only plausible deniability, but there's no deterministic way to trace through that transaction. And the beauty of it is you do all that without actually giving over custody to anyone. You never give up access to your Bitcoin. Mm. If the transaction that you're trying to do fails, your Bitcoin just stays yours. There's no way that like the coordinator, the person actually running the software that does this, could steal funds, because you're just working together with four other people to create one transaction together.
Well, the other classic pop culture reference for this, and people probably don't think about this, but regular bills printed by the United States, and I assume other countries too, have unique serial numbers on them. That's why the old in the old bank robbery movies, they're like the ransom was always in small unmarked bills, right? And non-sequential, you know, because you know the trick would be they give you the briefcase full of money, but they're all sequential serial numbers. So if you ever spent any of those bills, that they'd know it was you. So that's the closest analog I could think of to paper currency.
Yeah, it's pretty true in that when you use cash, it kind of has the pseudonymity of Bitcoin in a sense. It's better because almost no one actually checks that. Like the only time normally that the serial number is going to be checked is if you're like depositing them at a bank. That I believe that they check and catalog all the serial numbers of cash coming in.
Like maybe
in
the
and
little
out.
Cash counter things, the thing are actually taking.
I don't know when they actually check it. I know that it's possible, and I know like a friend was just showing me an old kind of mystery case about someone named Dan Cooper who essentially robbed an airline then jumped out of a plane.
DB Cooper? Oh yeah, classic
story. Yeah, DB Cooper.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was one who they put out info about all the serial numbers that they gave out because they had the serial numbers cataloged. So that came to mind when you mentioned that. It is definitely a prevention mechanism. And like you could do the same thing with Bitcoin in the sense of you could say like we paid out a ransom, let's say. We paid out a ransom to this address, so no one should interact with this address. And that actually happens today. So the U.S. Department of Treasury has a sanctions list that contains Bitcoin addresses and Bitcoin transactions that you shouldn't essentially take money from, et cetera. So the same concept applies in Bitcoin. But one of the beautiful things about Monero, and I'm not saying it's beautiful that you can do crime with it, but just beautiful in the privacy sense, is that there's no similar thing in Monero. You can't give out an address to people and say you shouldn't receive funds from this address because that information is not visible to anyone else. You can't blacklist single addresses or anything on Monero because an address on Monero is one-time use only. It's never going to be used again. It's never visible on chain. So there's a lot of extra protection that happens in Monero that doesn't happen in Bitcoin specifically.
So that begs the question for me, why don't ransomware actors require Monero? Why do they ask for Bitcoin?
So they actually do. For the last maybe 18 months or 2 years, they've been usually requesting Bitcoin and Monero. It depends on the exact ransomware team or company now that it's almost always ransomware as a service, which is crazy.
Yes.
But almost always they're requesting either Bitcoin or Monero. Sometimes they're even giving like a 20% discount if you pay in Monero because it's so much easier for them to maintain their privacy. As far as I know, the vast majority of ransom payments are still paid in Bitcoin, but that's mostly because the people paying the ransoms are almost always cybersecurity insurance companies, and they only want to deal in Bitcoin, both because it's traceable and because it's easier to source the amounts that they need. I mean, if you're talking like a $20 million ransom, that might be hard to secure in Monero quickly. It depends exactly. It's not necessarily true, but normally, as far as I know, they're paid out in Bitcoin. But they do usually request Monero as well, and it would make their lives easier, again, for better or for worse. Unfortunately, bad people use good tools to do bad things.
Yeah, and which is a topic we talk about in the show constantly.
Yeah.
You know, tools can be used both ways, right? Yeah, it's just technology. All right, so we've touched on the privacy aspects, and that's something I think a lot of people might understand or associate with cryptocurrency, but let's talk about some of the macroeconomic aspects for it and some of these kind of deeper principles involved in cryptocurrency. So obviously it's a decentralized currency, so as we said, it's a non-fiat, and that has its— I'd like to get your take on why this is a freedom— you call it a freedom tech, you know, why you think that is such an important aspect to current cryptocurrency. But then let's segue into the fact that the countries are now looking to create their own digital cash, what they are calling CBDC or central bank digital currencies. So tell us why you think that the current Bitcoins and Moneros of the world, what the value has from this freedom aspect, this privacy aspect, this broader capital P privacy aspect, and then what it means that nation states are trying to create this central bank-based currency.
Yeah, I think the answer to this question, you can go two different ways. And depending on the person you ask who's like into Bitcoin or Monero, you can get, I think, two general classes of answers. I think the first, when you're talking about something like Bitcoin, is that you have that decentralization, that lack of a nation state controlling the currency, which is really valuable from the sense of inflation protection, from capital controls protection, essentially protecting you against a government doing something that benefits them and harms you as the individual. And we've seen this historically many times over the history of the world, where a government essentially destroys their own currency trying to save themselves. Mm-hmm. And that can't happen with Bitcoin, which is one of the real powerful things about it. Now, that's most important if you're looking at Bitcoin as a wealth preservation tool, which is a completely valid, legitimate way to approach it. And I think when you talk to people in a lot of the Western world, especially in the US, almost everyone is approaching Bitcoin that way, where they want a way to preserve their wealth that doesn't get destroyed by inflation, that doesn't get destroyed by a stock market collapse necessarily. Again, these things they're speculative. So a lot of times Bitcoin moves in correlation with stock markets and with inflation, et cetera. It's not necessarily a market hedge against these things, but it's a technical hedge against these things. So whether that will separate or not in the future, if we have like hyperinflation with the dollar, will Bitcoin perform well and give you better protection than if you were in dollars? We'll see.
Well, just to introduce an anecdote to that, when I was in South America many years ago, and you know, in the U.S., maybe we're spoiled because the U.S. dollar is so often used as a global currency, as a stable global currency. But when we were in several countries in South America at the time, and this was many years ago, but there were a lot of the local currencies were highly inflationary to the point where people would, as soon as they got paid, they would immediately walk out literally on street corners. There were people on street corners with massive wads of U.S. bills, and they would trade in their local currency for U.S. bills because the U.S. dollar would hold its value so much better than their local currency.
Yeah, it's definitely the case, and that continues to be the case. I mean, there's been a lot of hyperinflation in South America over the past 5-10 years, and even though we've had Bitcoin, anecdotally, it's interesting to notice that almost no one is using Bitcoin as a hedge against inflation in these countries, because the dollar is so prevalent. Mm-hmm. They still want dollars. They can't spend Bitcoin at many places, mm-hmm. unfortunately. They still want dollars because most people are going to accept that. And if they don't get physical dollars, the most prevalent cryptocurrency by far in those situations are what are called stable coins, which is essentially dollar-backed cryptocurrencies. Things like USDT, which is called Tether, or USDC. And both of those there's a central company that handles a reserve of dollars or other assets and backs the dollar tie of that cryptocurrency, where it should be worth a dollar for every unit of that cryptocurrency, no matter what. And that has been by far the most desired and useful cryptocurrency to people in those markets, which is interesting because in theory, Bitcoin is the hedge against that, but the dollar is so dominant still that people just want what they can spend easily and what they know, even if, yes, there is inflation in the dollar. Obviously, 7 to 10% inflation is nothing if your local currency is inflating 100%, 1,000% a year.
Right.
7 to 10% looks golden. Yeah. And you also don't have the volatility of Bitcoin if you're using dollars.
Sure.
And sometimes volatility of Bitcoin is good for you. Sometimes it's bad. But when you're talking $10 a day or something, if you have a 50% drop off in Bitcoin because someone tweeted something, it could be really harmful to your specific family. So I think that says more about the state of Bitcoin and the state of its what we call circular economy, basically whether or not you can actually spend Bitcoin places. Mm. And that has really been a detractor for the adoption of Bitcoin as an actual digital cash, as an actual currency, which is kind of the other flip side of that coin I was talking about earlier, is you can use Bitcoin, and I think even more so Monero because of its privacy guarantees, but you can use Bitcoin as digital cash, where maybe you either also view it as wealth preservation, or maybe you're only interested in a tool that you can spend freely without surveillance, without anyone being able to control it. and you want to use it for that digital cash purpose. And Bitcoin in theory fits that really, really well. But the problem has been that not many places have actually adopted accepting Bitcoin directly. That is getting better over time, slowly increasing the tools for merchants to actually accept Bitcoin have gotten a lot better, I would say, especially in the last 3 to 5 years. But that is the biggest shortcoming, and I think why most people don't, even when you would think Bitcoin would be the perfect tool, they're not using Bitcoin. Because if I, let's say I'm holding a currency that's hyperinflating and I swap it into Bitcoin, that's great. Now I have good purchasing power. But now either I need to swap back into the local currency when I need to buy something, right, or I need to hope that I can find someone who will actually accept Bitcoin, which is rare. It is increasing, but it's still pretty rare. And that's almost always the shortcoming of Bitcoin and all cryptocurrencies, honestly, is that if we want to use them as digital cash, we have to actually get people on board with that notion. And that requires getting merchants, getting businesses, getting large enterprises in with the idea of actually accepting these things as digital cash, because money isn't really useful in a vacuum. If I can't spend it on anything,
right,
I can preserve wealth in it, but it's a lot harder to actually use it as money. And like you mentioned with the dollar, that one of the beautiful things about, and one of the best things about being a US citizen at this point, is that the dollar is extremely powerful worldwide, and I can go almost anywhere in the world and expect that my dollars will be accepted and often even prized over local currencies, which isn't the case with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies today.
Well, and again, I'm not a economist, but there was a similar thing actually with cash, but back when the cash used to be on the gold standard, where there was somewhere a certain amount of gold set aside for every one of those physical dollar bills you had. And we went away from that, and then it allowed that to kind of fluctuate and speculation to happen on US dollars that, you know, we didn't have before. Seems like kind of a similar situation where, because gold had intrinsic value, whereas paper money was really a promissory note from the government that backed that coin, fiat currency, right? And without the gold standard, we're somewhere in, you know, Fort Knox or something was a gold bar with your name on it, so to speak, you know, against the paper dollar you had that it allowed to fluctuate. So it seems like it's kind of almost a similar thing, and now it's just the digital version of that.
Yeah, and I think to tie in the CBDC topic, yes, that you wanted to segue into as well, like the one of the interesting downsides to Bitcoin being created, and I don't think this obviously was the intent with whoever created Bitcoin. Of course, there are some interesting theories that like the NSA or CIA or someone created Bitcoin because they wanted to get CBDCs to be this thing in the future. But one of the interesting downsides to Bitcoin being created is that governments have seen that there is appetite for a digital currency and that people are willing to take these things on if there's enough benefit to them. And so this, I think the concept of a CBDC, of a central bank digital currency, has really been normalized by Bitcoin. As weird as that sounds,
sure, yeah,
because Bitcoin is in many ways the antithesis of right, a CBDC.
Right.
But it's gotten this concept across to people where, I mean, in my generation, we don't usually deal with cash anyways.
Right.
So it's already pretty native for like me and my peers to not handle cash. I only really started caring about cash when I started caring about privacy. And I was like, oh, this is actually awesome. Like it's really nice to have cash.
Right.
But this concept of a digital currency is pretty normalized already within my generation. But I think Bitcoin's kind of been the final nail in the coffin for physical currencies and has laid the path out for governments to put forth CBDCs. And I don't know exactly what angle you want to take, but the biggest concern I have with CBDCs is that while we have the bad macro aspects of fiat currency, like the dollar, where governments can inflate it and they can print as much as they want of it. We saw a lot of this during the COVID craziness. The government can't easily prevent me from using it how I want. Usually the person who's actually going to put any kind of controls on it is going to be my local bank or maybe my credit card company, someone who at least is like one step away from the government, where they still obviously are having to abide by laws that the government puts forward,
right,
but they have different incentives than the government does. So I have some protection there. And then with physical cash, I had the ultimate protection when we're talking about the cash side of money, in that I can spend it. Almost no one can prevent me from spending it how I want, and almost no one can surveil how I spend it. So cash is really like the ideal form of fiat currency, as weird as that sounds in 2024.
Right.
But it really is in many ways. And that's what things like Monero are emulating, is taking the best parts of cash, but pulling it out of the state, Whereas CBDCs are essentially taking the worst parts of fiat currency and giving more control over to the state. So you're really starting to pull across two different parts of the spectrum with something like Bitcoin and Monero versus something like a CBDC, where one grants freedom from government control and one cements government control.
In my limited understanding of this, I've seen at least two different ways that governments are considering using it. And one is straight up digital cash, something that you and I could, you know, split a lunch bill over CBDC, versus this kind of world that most of us don't see behind the scenes, where it's banks and the Federal Reserve and some of these really high dollar, esoteric, macroeconomic weird things that most of us don't understand, that I don't understand, where it might be, to me in my head quickly, that it seems like the internet backbone versus Wi-Fi at my house. I mean, there's just different elements of scale. And one of these happens in some magical way that I never see, that nevertheless makes the whole world go around. And then there's the me, kind of at the leaf of the tree, where these kind of small micro transactions go on. And I think they're the terms I've heard is retail versus wholesale. Are governments equally interested in both of those? And why might they favor one versus the other? Or which one might maybe come to happen first versus the other?
Yeah, I think the dream for governments is both retail and wholesale, because generally the easier part of the populace to control or to get to go along with the direction a government wants to go, for good or for bad, is the enterprise, the business, because they have a lot of different reporting requirements. They have a lot more, they're a lot more impacted directly by things that the government does rather than just the individual consumer. So I think that's the easiest place to start. And like, that's where we've seen the US has started with this FedNow system, which, if anyone knows, and I may be butchering this because this is also not my area of expertise, but there's this system called SWIFT that's kind of like a global form of FedNow.
Yeah.
It's not dollar denominated necessarily, but it's a system to allow people to settle obligations in a way that is international and that is digital.
Right.
The same... In my view, FedNow is essentially like a dollar-denominated and a U.S.-dominated form of that, where they can gain some more control, some more oversight with how businesses actually send and receive money to each other. So that's the wholesale angle, and that's where they're starting right now. I mean, it's been clear that the U.S. would love to do something at the retail level, but that's a really hard sell in the U.S. We've already seen lots of states already put out legislation banning the use of CBDCs within the state government, preventing people from being able to take it as payment as a state employee, essentially putting in all of the preventions they can do at the state level to CBDC adoption. And I think there will be a lot of pushback in the US against CBDCs. I don't know when or if a retail CBDC would happen in the US. It feels like it's at least a long ways out. But that's not true of every nation. And China has been, as they are in many things, and I don't just want this to be just a kind of anti-China thing, but a lot of the interesting privacy and sovereignty things that happen that are against privacy and sovereignty start in China, or Canada for some reason, even though they're so close to the US. But in China, they've had a CBDC for some time, and they've been slowly rolling it out. They started with wholesale, is my understanding, but they've been doing retail for a long time at this point. It's not available to every citizen, is my understanding, and it's kind of like a phased rollout. But they have what's called the digital yuan. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, but however you pronounce that,
I think it's just yuan.
Yuan. Okay, digital yuan, and it's a separate app. It's a separate currency, but they already have merchants supporting it, so you can pay in stores. They have, of course, unique incentives that you only get if you start to use the digital yuan and use the app that they give. Exactly, and that's the easy. That's the easy carrot way to to get people involved. You give out free bus passes, free train tickets. You give out discounts at vendors, and you can do this because you're the government. So you can just print the money to pay for it. This is a CBDC. You don't even have to physically print anymore.
Right. Which is a big deal.
Makes that even easier. Yeah. A lot of things are simplified when you can just change the number on a spreadsheet and suddenly there's more of your currency. But China has been leading the way in this. There's a lot of research around it. I've summarized some of it in an article I wrote on freedom.tech, which I can give you the link to that kind of talks about CBDCs generally. But China has definitely been leading the way on that. There's also a really fantastic tool that I'll also give you the link to that the Human Rights Foundation, who are really deeply intertwined with the Bitcoin space, they've created, or I should say they made a grant and some people came together to create a tool for tracking the development of CBDCs around the world so that you can quickly see for any given country, your country or someone else's, what the state of CBDC development is within your country and get some better ideas around like what to expect, what to push back on, and helps the awareness. Because for a lot of people, it's either CBDCs are in the world or they're like, what the hell is a CBDC? And there's not a lot in the middle. There's not a lot of nuance right now. So resources like that are really, really helpful.
So I definitely want to check out those tools. That'd be great. But do you, off the top of your head, like, where's the U.S. right now? Where do we stand in the U.S. with CBDC?
Yeah, I think it's clear that the U.S. government really wants to do a CBDC retail and wholesale. They put a lot of time and energy into research around how exactly this could be done. Interestingly enough, even some really good cryptographers and people helping the U.S. government figure out ways that they could do a CBDC. There's even been proposals on how a CBDC could happen that would be privacy preserving, which is fascinating. Yeah. And it is cryptographically possible. So that would be an interesting path to go down, in that we could theoretically get privacy comparable to cash in a CBDC. But obviously that harms a lot of the things that the government would generally want to get out of a CBDC, right, which is surveillance. So that's something that is an interesting avenue. There's a lot of really smart people that have worked on that. Which is it's an interesting place to work because they often get maligned by the privacy space. Sure. Because obviously we don't want a CBDC in general. But if there is any wiggle room within the U.S. government, like if there are good people that actually care about these things happening, it would be fascinating. If a CBDC is going to happen anyways, and it seems like the U.S. government wants to make it happen, if we can do that in a way that's privacy preserving, it's a fascinating angle. Obviously, will that happen? Will the government have back doors into whatever privacy approach is taken? Those are all very valid and important questions. But overall, as far as I understand it, the U.S. has done a lot of research. They've explored CBDCs for retail. But right now, the only existent system is that FedNow system, which is just wholesale. It's just business to business, bank to bank. There's no actual exposure to us as the individual, and there's no slated timeline or anything like that. And I think I touched on a little bit earlier, but there's also a lot of pushback already on the concept of CBDCs within state governments. A few different ones. I think North Carolina, Florida, South Carolina, maybe. I think there might have been a few others that have already passed anti-CBDC legislature.
And is that coming from kind of this, you know, the stereotypical U.S. don't tread on me, you know, anti-tyrannical government perspective, where the states are standing up and saying the privacy aspects are important, the traceability aspects? Is that where it's coming from, these states that are trying to ban it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, I mean, the majority of those states, not to get political, are generally more conservative. And it is a lot more of that background of like big government bad. So we don't want to give big government right. tools that would give them broader control over both the individual and companies. So I think that's the broad sentiment behind it. I think there's a reasonable amount of bipartisan support for this in many places. But it's definitely going to be interesting to see how that goes. I think some has been said about the privacy aspects, but I think the bigger concern for most people is just that it would give the federal government massive control over states as well. So it kind of gets into the issue of how much power states actually have if suddenly they don't have control over currency now, but there's a lot more freedom in how the individual states' residents spend money. But if suddenly the federal government has complete control, can do things like capital controls, can do things like deflationary currency, can take money out of your account for whatever reason, it strips away some power from the states themselves as well. So I think that's a lot of where it's coming from, but I'm sure it differs based on who you're talking to that's anti-CBDC.
Well, and you mentioned that, that there's been some backlash. The other thing that made me think about this is we're weird in the U.S. when it comes to money and cash. Like we've been trying to get rid of the penny for decades, and we just have this love for physical coins. I think that there's been such backlash when people try to stop minting pennies because they're expensive. The metal that goes into making those coins is not cheap to the point where it's hard to make a penny that costs less than a penny to make.
I think it already costs more than a penny to make a penny, which is hilarious.
Right. And paper bills too. I mean, they don't hold up that well. They have to make them. They have to remake paper bills pretty often and take the other ones out of circulation. So I think just from that kind of a production perspective, the government would like to go to a digital cash as well.
I think there could be a lot of benefits, like what we talked about a little bit before about a CBDC that's actually privacy preserving. If it's done in a way that's privacy preserving and is verifiably privacy preserving instead of just a trust me, it's privacy preserving system. If it's done in the right way, it's actually fascinating because, I mean, as much as I am a Bitcoiner, a Monero user, a privacy advocate, I still have to use dollars a lot. The vast majority of the time I'm using dollars. I would love to be able to do that in a way that's privacy preserving, but also digital. Because I can do that in cash in person, but like mailing cash to people is a nightmare. So I would even like that. The problem is, will that actually happen? And what other control would we give up in order to gain that privacy preserving nature? Would we be giving up the ability to actually decide what's in our bank accounts? Would the government just be able to take money out if we do something wrong? Would the government just be able to say, we need more money to fund this war, so we're subtracting 10% from everybody's savings accounts? Or like what systems would be in place that would also lend themselves towards tyranny? And that's where it gets a little scarier. But the privacy preserving piece could be interesting. Obviously, I think there's very little hope that if a CBDC were to launch in the US, it would be privacy preserving in nature. But it's an interesting thought experiment at the very least.
Well, I think one of the beauties of cryptocurrency and cryptography in general is that it's just math. Like, even if the U.S. forces everybody to go to digital cash, you're never going to get rid of Bitcoin and Monero and these other things. They like, you literally can't stop them. And I would think that if we ever got to the point where a government would try to do the kind of things that we're speculating that could be tyrannical or otherwise bad, that's just going to force people to, A, not only move to these things like Monero and Bitcoin, but I think push us over the edge to the point where we will start transacting in those digital currencies directly, getting around the other limitation you were talking about earlier.
I definitely agree. The only pushback I would have is that if a CBDC is widely adopted, it would become much more difficult to acquire Bitcoin or Monero if acquiring them were to be made illegal. So it's I would say, utterly impossible for like the US government to prevent Bitcoin or Monero being used by the average individual. It's too easy to do, too easy to run a node, too easy to hide the fact that you're using these things. There's not a way they're going to prevent that. And like you said, it's just math. It's basic software. There's nothing crazy. It's impossible for them to stop. But the thing that they can stop, which we kind of talked about at the top of the show, is that they can make it hard when you want to buy or sell Bitcoin or Monero. Right now, the best workarounds for the privacy invasiveness of the legacy financial system and the idea of KYC is that you can still, I'm not a lawyer, but legally buy and sell Bitcoin and Monero directly with other people in small amounts. If you're doing that at large scale, it's usually considered money transmission. So that can change. And I'm not a lawyer, consult your lawyer, blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, right.
But you can still do that today. And the vast majority of the ways that's done is physical cash. If not physical cash, it's done through apps like Cash App or in the EU, like Revolut. There's lots of interesting ways to do it. But if suddenly we actually switch over to this digital CBDC system where the government has immense surveillance and control, it would be a lot easier for them to detect and prevent that type of behavior and make it much harder for you to actually get Bitcoin or Monero. So it's one of these situations where at that point, I would hesitate to say that it's too late, but it would be way harder for you to actually acquire that directly by giving over money. That's not to say at that point you couldn't sell goods and services. Very likely there would essentially be just an entire black market that would be spawned overnight, where there would be people selling goods and services for illegal cryptocurrencies. And that would be the way you could acquire them. Because even if you can't directly give over your CBDC dollars for Bitcoin without it being surveilled and prevented, what you can do is just sell some of your labor, do something that you're good at, and earn Bitcoin or Monero that way. And that's still a very common way to earn Bitcoin right now. It's a lot easier. It's easier to do it in a way that doesn't give over your ID to the government or to an exchange. So that's already valuable. But there's just this concept of either you'll need to be able to kind of work for it at that point, or think about how do I have some in advance so that I have a kind of a I don't know, get out of jail free card is probably an ironically bad thing to call it, but get into jail easily card and have some Bitcoin or Monero or both so that you're prepared for something like this. It's an interesting, again, a thought experiment. It depends on your kind of threat model, what your idea of the future is, but there's something to be said for getting some while it's easier rather than waiting for a pressing need. And hopefully we don't go full dystopian. We don't go full CBDC in the US and that kind of thing never happens. But it would be, I think, immensely more difficult to acquire Bitcoin or Monero in a situation where a digital CBDC is actually adopted.
All right, before I let you go, looking in your crystal ball, what do you think is on the near horizon, you know, or maybe, you know, near and midterm horizon for cryptocurrency? What kind of things are going to be coming that we haven't seen yet? What kind of changes do you think might be coming? We've obviously talked about CBDC, which is on the horizon, but what else is going to be happening, do you think, in the realm of cryptocurrency that we maybe have not seen before, good or bad? And then maybe what do you hope is going to happen? What is it you're waiting? Is there anything you've been waiting for to happen with cryptocurrency that has yet to materialize?
I'll tackle the waiting for first, because I think that's one that ties in well to what we've already been talking about. The biggest thing for me that I would love to see is just people start to understand that there are real world benefits to human freedom when something like Bitcoin or Monero is widely adopted. And I would just love to see, especially those people who are already Bitcoiners, who already see the value in cryptocurrencies, to actually embrace it in the sense of spending it and accepting it. Even if you're not a merchant, you have something that you do that makes you unique, something that you're really good at. And just selling goods and services for Bitcoin or Monero brings immense value to the actual freedom those things can give. Because like we talked about before, the easiest way for governments to prevent these things to be useful, or just generally for bad people to prevent them being useful, is just make it so you can't spend them anywhere. And if you can't spend them anywhere, they're not actually that useful as freedom tech. A lot of the value comes from the fact that comes from the scenario that unfortunately is not usually the case, where you can actually spend them directly for goods and services and you don't have to go back through fiat.
Right.
So I think that's the thing that I'm most hopeful for, is that improvement that we've seen in circular economies will just go fully exponential, and we'll see a massive growth in adoption, and we'll see people start to truly grasp the digital cash side of these things rather than just the wealth preservation side. As far as what I'm most excited for, I think I'll give one thing for Bitcoin and one for Monero. So on the Bitcoin side, I hinted at this earlier, but there's been a really good shift in the Bitcoin community to understanding that we need to make it easier for the average human being to use Bitcoin, to use it at scale, and to use it without massive fees. We can't just, if we keep things status quo, we're essentially locking Bitcoin into a system that only very wealthy users can use. We're locking out much of the developing world because fees are just going to be too much for the average person who's not making $100,000 a year and is lucky to be making $10 a year. They can't afford an $8 transaction fee when they're making $10 a day. So that's, I think, the most encouraging thing, is there's been a shift in the community to understand that and to really start wrestling with how do we improve Bitcoin to make it a more useful tool for the average person. And so there's some really interesting ideas around layer two networks. It gets pretty technical quickly, but essentially just ways to be able to move Bitcoin into an alternative layer, not have to transact on chain every time, but be able to send and receive Bitcoin directly with other people with either very low transaction fees or no transaction fees, with almost all of the security benefits of Bitcoin itself. And those systems are progressing, are getting built, and I'm excited to see what happens there. It's hard to say concretely what will happen within the next like year, but there's some really exciting developments there where I'm hoping we can build something much better than the existing Lightning Network and make Bitcoin a much more useful tool for the average person out there. And then for Monero, I think the biggest thing is just that there's a really big update to Monero. It's called Seraphis, is kind of its code name within the Monero community. But essentially just what it is it's a lot of quality of life improvements for Monero to make it, again, more useful for the average individual, to make actually using Monero wallets easier, to make using different types of Monero wallets easier. And then the biggest thing is it's going to overhaul the way that sender privacy actually works in Monero, Right now, when you send a transaction to Monero, you essentially hide amongst 15 other potential senders in what's called a ring signature, which works well. It's good plausible deniability, but in specific targeted scenarios, you can't actually be traced through Monero transactions. It's not untraceable as much as people like to kind of bandy that term around when you talk about Monero. It's very hard to trace, and in many cases impossible to trace, but not always. What this shift will do is it'll change from you hiding amongst 15 other potential senders whenever you send a transaction to you hiding amongst every historical sender ever in Monero's blockchain. So it's something called full chain membership proofs, but essentially just will make it, it'll vastly improve the sender privacy of Monero and fix really the only remaining issue with, or potential issue with privacy in Monero. So that's a huge update that's coming probably in 2 years. It's hard to say in a decentralized project like this exactly when it'll happen, but there's a lot of really smart people working really hard on that.
All right, I lied. There was one more question that I meant to ask earlier. I forgot, but I want to get your take on this before we go. What is going on with Bitcoin price? I mean, Bitcoin has been speculative for a long time, and it's been crazy in that way. It's sort of the nature of Bitcoin and our fascination with these new technologies. But it went really down, and then it went way up. And I know that someone mentioned this Bitcoin halving thing that's coming up soon, and that's H-A-L-V-I-N-G, halving. Are those two things related? If not, regardless, what's halving and what's going on with Bitcoin?
Yeah, so the halving is, it's a hard word to say on air without writing it out. It's essentially just that every 4 years within Bitcoin, the goal when Bitcoin was created was that eventually there would be very, very low to zero inflation long term. So right now there is technically inflation, but there's a hard cap on how many Bitcoin there will ever be. Mm-hmm. So you know exactly there will be 21 million, no more. Theoretically less, actually, because people lose Bitcoin all the time. Yes. But no more than 21 million. And so to actually put that into practice, the people who created Bitcoin really kind of did it in a stupid way, if I'm being honest. It's not actually beneficial, but it makes for some fun community events where every 4 years, the amount of Bitcoin that's emitted in each block to the people mining Bitcoin, which is a reward to essentially incentivize them to keep securing Bitcoin, the amount that they're actually issued in each block gets halved. It gets cut in half. And so the halving is just kind of a term we use and a way to celebrate this as just an event within Bitcoin. There is a lot of speculation on the drop in supply, ensuring price increases. Bitcoin's so speculative, I'm not going to jump in there and say that that will directly correlate to a price increase. Historically, it has, but that could also just be coincidence. I think probably the bigger thing affecting Bitcoin price, and Bitcoin price is not my area of expertise, so just take everything I say with a grain of salt. I am legitimately in it for the tech as much as that is a meme. But I think the bigger thing for price is just that the Bitcoin ETFs got approved a few months ago.
Okay.
And so there's a massive amount of new capital, especially in like people's retirement funds, that they can put into actual spot Bitcoin ETFs, where the ETFs have to actually hold Bitcoin to sell these things. So there's a massive increase in demand over what was present previously.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, to say that's necessarily the cause for the increase, it's hard to say. Sure. There's so many market forces at work. But I think that's a really big one and is driving a lot of recognition of Bitcoin that wasn't there for a long time. And just a lot of people's money is able to move into Bitcoin that they couldn't otherwise do, because otherwise they'd have to take like a tax hit and all of this stuff to like sell a 401k and put it into Bitcoin. Now you can just shift it into an ETF. Now, full disclaimer, an ETF does not actually give you custody of Bitcoin. You don't gain any of the freedom principles that I mentioned before. It is wealth preservation through Bitcoin, as long as that ETF thrives, governments are good, blah, blah, blah. But it's an interesting thing for price speculation at the very least.
And maybe it just adds another layer of legitimacy to the Bitcoin that the general populace. All right. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Seth. That was fascinating as always. And, when the inevitable next big cryptocurrency thing occurs, we'll have to bring you back sooner than 2 years.
Hopefully sooner than 2 years for sure. Yeah. I had an absolute blast, Kerry. I love your questions and your perspective. It's very different than most of the kind of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency podcasts I get to go on, which is really refreshing, honestly. So it's fun to get to talk through a lot of these things and see where I assume that everyone thinks the same way I do, especially when talking about like Bitcoin transaction fees and then understanding that like not everyone thinks about Bitcoin as much as I do every day. So yeah, it's been really fun. Thank you for having me on. Hopefully we'll do this again within 2 years.
All right. Thanks, Seth. Take care. Big thanks to Seth for coming on the show. He obviously really knows what he's talking about, and I do not. Cryptocurrency is very interesting technology, but it really has some very interesting impacts on privacy and anonymity and democracy. And let's face it, for society. And it's the final chapter has not been written. There's a lot more to come. And one of the next big chapters is CBDC. Again, if you want to learn more about the basics of cryptocurrency, what it is, how it works, how you get it, how you transact with it, go back and check out our Cryptocurrency 101 podcast. And of course, there is a link in the show notes. But I will say, and Seth kind of mentioned this, is the time to learn about how to use cryptocurrency, honestly, like any privacy technology, is before you need to use it. So I would love to encourage all of you to go out there and play around with it a little bit yourselves. Get into the point where you actually have like a wallet app. I would recommend what they call a cold wallet, where you have full control of your currency as opposed to what a hot wallet is. And I hope I'm not getting these terms wrong. A hot wallet is where you actually have a third party entrusted with the custody of your cryptocurrency. I don't think that's a good idea. There's been way too many scams and hacks and things like that. I think you want to control it yourself. Cake Wallet is a good start. He did mention Samurai Wallet, which was recently, well, its founders were arrested by the U.S. government because they were doing some stuff that was not legal, allegedly. So if you were using that particular wallet, I'm not actually sure what's going on with your services, though I'm sure they probably reached out to you, or maybe you've been reading some news about it. But Seth did recently write a couple articles about that, and I've got the most recent one that he's written since we did the interview and his take on how this all went down. There's a link to that in the show notes, so you might want to check that out. I've got some other links in the show notes as well. Seth talked about the Human Rights Foundation's CBDC tracker tool. That is cbdctracker.hrf.org. But I've got a link to that in the show notes, as well as to Seth's wonderful podcast called Opt Out and his website, freedom.tech. So Seth and I actually traded interviews just last week. He interviewed me for his podcast, and we talked more about general privacy topics. I don't have a link for that right now, but if you go to optoutpod.com, that should be showing up there soon. It might even be out by the time you hear this, but if not, it should be out very soon. Of course, I gathered some extra Q&A with Seth for my patrons, which will come out for them on Thursday as usual. We talked about WorldCoin, which is Sam Altman's supposedly altruistic cryptocurrency for kind of like the third world, for people who are generally not banked, and the really weird orb device that he used to scan people's irises in order to associate that with their wallets. And that kind of led to discussing, you know, about cryptocurrency today and how much of it is truly altruistic versus, you know, just greedy or whatever. And I also debuted an idea that I've been thinking about for quite a while now, about what you might call boilerplate or standardized or even maybe open source privacy policies, and kind of my idea about that. So anyway, the patrons will get that as usual on Thursday. All right, we'll have our news show next week as normal. I've got those great interviews coming up with Dina Temple-Rastin about cyber war in Ukraine, and a great discussion with Naomi Brockwell about privacy. Several other great interviews are already in the works, so if you haven't subscribed already, now would be a great time to do that, and that way you won't miss any of it. Again, the Treasure and Coin promo is almost over, at least the coin part of that. Go to fdsd.me/promo424. You could send me questions at fdsd.me/Q&A. You could find out about the book at that same address /book. You can get my newsletter at that same address /newsletter. And you could get some really cool Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons merch just in time for summer at that same base URL /merch. And of course, all of this is in the show notes. So that'll do it for this week. Stay safe out there, everybody. And until next time, as always, don't get caught with your drawbridge down.